Dr. Chitwood, we've talked about your residency and your medical training and your contributions to getting the Heart Center started here at East Carolina and at Pitt County Memorial Hospital. When you think back on it, who were some of the people, aside from your father, who had important influences on your life, your career in medicine?
Well, I think you only have four or five real mentors in your life. Certainly my dad was, because I think he taught me the basic principles, the interest in the history of medicine, the interest in the history, that the history is not important just for history's sake, but as it is it's a matrix, a helix that went before that, you can get a lot of information from the history. Let's see, look at a picture of Claude Bernard there. Milieu interne, homeostasis. You realize that Claude Bernard in 1850, 1860, was able to understand that there was a autoregulatory system within the animal system. So to understand that man is to understand what we're looking at now in feedback mechanisms, whether they're immunologic feedback mechanisms or stem cells or transplantation or whatever, or endocrine feedback mechanisms. It's an understanding of the past. So my dad taught me a fundamental understanding of the past, that these men and women were just as we are in a different era with less resources, electronic resources, but applied them very well, such as Ernest Starling, who really has done the same thing we do with Echo today, at the University College in London in 1912. So he taught me that, and he taught me the basics of taking care of patients in the bedside manner and all that. I had a chance to see that. He was an amazing individual in that respect. My other mentors, really, it was after college. There's a big high, I guess, in high school, there are a few people that I admired a lot. One is Mrs. Young, who was a superb woman. She was one of Robert Frost's students, even in a small town. She had gotten an M.A. from Middlebury, the Bredlove School of English, and she was an absolute taskmaster in high school about grammar, understanding Spencer, and all kinds of stuff. I mean, it was a college, clearly a college level English course, which I had for all 4 years in high school. I had the same person, and she would only have people in that class that could move up to the next level. That she had a theme throughout the 4 years, and I'm ever grateful because of she was a fantastic grammarian. She made you speak extemporaneously to be able to quote poetry, to memorize things, to write well, and to be critical of your writing and to analyze your writing. So she was a very important person in my later abilities. Skip 20 years, now she becomes very important. Oh yeah, high school.
Fabulous, though.
George With High School, and then George With High School. Of course, you're always influenced by your coaches and stuff in football. I play football, and you're always discipline associated with sports. Sports teaches teamsmanship, to work with a bunch of folks for a common goal, even though you have disparate alignments of initiatives. Then I guess Ed Crawford at Hampden, Sydney. Ed was a taskmaster who was almost to the point that he would make you so angry, because Ed was dissections, fine anatomic dissections, every nerve, every detail, every crinkle in the embryo that you're looking at under the microscope. Rote memorization, understanding at the same time. He would actually bait you. He'd say the guy ahead of you is got 2 points ahead of you, and then he'd tell you that you're 2 points behind. He'd instill competition in you, and what he did is he turned out a bunch of people who became doctors and scientists, and they all got there. Even though you may have been 2 points behind the other guy, he still made an A. He didn't give out A's very often. And
this
so,
was a physiology teacher?
No, it was an embryology comparative anatomy teacher. And Ed was a tough master. And I'd cuss at Ed, and not to his face, but he spoke with a South Carolina accent. He said, "Yeah, Chidwood, you're not doing as good a job as you can, boy. Joe Austin's beating you, I tell you. He's going to beat you on this test." He would take off 5 points for misspelled word. Okay? And so that guy taught me all kinds of neuroembryology, comparative anatomy, a little bit in the spirit of John Hunter. You'll have to ask me about the heroes of yore that are important. They're as important an influence as my modern-day teachers. Because basically, if you look at John Hunter's work on comparative anatomy, it comes back to the comparative anatomy that Ed Crawford taught me. Fine dissections, late at night, hard work, you know.
But at least it was legal.
At least it was legal as an animal. Then, what was that influence in medical school? I think in medical school I had some great heroes. Julian Beckwith, who was the chief of cardiology, was a great influence on me because he'd been a very good friend of my father's. And he was the kindly, old, gentlemanly cardiologist who had eyes and ears and great perception of cardiac disease, yet had a bit of science in him. And he had a horse named Consultation, and there was always a joke that he would say Dr. Beckwith was out on consultation. And I was very devoted to Dr. Beckwith, as he was to me, and of course his son George and our great friends, who's one of my referring cardiologists now in New Bern. And in fact, George gave me, after his death, his copy of Osler's textbook of medicine. He was a classic Oslerian kind of physician. Then I think at Duke, of course, Dr. Savison influenced me a lot. Dr. Savison was a surgeon larger than life, in that he was probably the most important educator of this century, or at least the latter half of this century in surgery. And he trained a school of surgeons who became professors. And actually, he's asked me to write his biography. So Savison was a demanding mentor, somewhat cold in nature, in that he, you know, is not your best friend. You clearly worked for him. And yet he would be very demanding. He would really, they wouldn't tell you how you were doing. I thought 50 papers was probably about average, and I found that I was way ahead of the pack. So, you know, he just had high expectations, yet when he took you to the national meetings, he would praise you in front of people and say, "This young man is going to be the president of the American College of Surgeons." You know, and he would tell people, and then he'd get you at home, and if there's some problem, you know, can't I trust you? I mean, you know, what's wrong? Do you have a brain tumor, young man? But you have to learn to work with guys like that, which is, you know, not that hard. My father was awfully demanding. Ed Crawford was more demanding. So Dr. Savison, I once told him, I says, you know, you're just in line with the rest of them. Then Walter Poore, I mentioned Andy Wexler at Duke, who taught me a lot of science. I worked in his laboratory. He taught me a lot of surgical technique. I'm devoted to Andy. When I had any personal problems, he was an attending there. I would go spend time with him, and he had sort of helped me work those things out and became a true friend, is now the chairman at Hahnemann. After I left Duke, I came here, and Dr. Poore became a friend and mentor. Different style than Savison, a much more worldly style of teaching you the more streetwise things like leadership, of how to lead people, you know, management of money, budget, you know, how to get things done in a difficult, complex, unworkable state system. how to cope with this. How to build things when resources are plentiful. How to build them when they're limited. But to keep progressing. So he taught me an awful lot of stuff. Those are sort of my main mentors. Of course, I have mentors every day, in my young faculty. They teach me, you know, what to do. Guys like Mike Rotundo and Bill Wooden and Paul Cunningham and, you know, and Carl Heisch and Mark Williams, my associates, and John Moran, all these guys teach me stuff every day. These surgeons who are not much younger than I am, but are junior to me in the department, but I listen to them as my security council, my national security council or council of chiefs. And of course, you know, your leading influence is often your spouse. She preserves the same principles, the same ideals, I think, that I have of honesty and integrity, hard work, getting the job done, no matter what the cost. No matter what the personal cost, you know, I mean, obviously, you want it to be legal and and not hurt someone. But the idea is, if it's for the greater good. She also taught me the art of philanthropy. In other words, basically, we need to put back into our society, either through your efforts as being in service organizations, or through your financial contributions. That it's just as important. And she got that from her dad, who was a great gentleman who was, you know, kind to a fault sometimes. He would always take care of the poor child who couldn't pay this, would buy him a coat and do this and not let him know that he'd bought it and do it so he could have it with dignity. And he just took care of people. And so I learned a lot from Tammy on that.
What was her father's profession?
He was the principal of our high school.
Oh.
So, you know,
daughter.
Right, so you end up with a number of mentors, probably of those, my father, Dr. Savison, Walter, would be more the more outstanding of the group, but it's hard to separate.
Surely. Well, you've also had the opportunity to travel, Dr. Chitwood, all around the world and participate in research. What areas, what people, what types of work, what places have been important to you?
Oh, I think it's a potpourri. You look at your curriculum vitae, you know, who knows? You know, I like the basic science. I like to go into the great science laboratories of the world. I also like to go in the clinical science, you know, see the applications as well. You know, it's nice to talk to people like Mahdi Yaqub, who's been knighted last year for his work in cellular biology, but is also one of the best technical surgeons in the world. And it just, as you move up the scale and have an opportunity to meet one-on-one with them, not in an awe-stricken sort of relationship, but in a relationship that you are respected for what you do and can, you know, I don't want to say be buddies, but close to buddies, you know, totally interact on a very personal basis with all facade removed and all patina of professorial standoffishness, you know, all gone. You're sitting down and talking to these folks, and it's really amazing. Let's talk about, you know, what happens if we get a retrovirus from animals back in the human strain, and how we're going to handle it. Well, at least we'll learn how to handle these retroviruses. It may carry us ahead farther. What do you think about this, thinking out of the box? You know, the robotic stuff's been very interesting. It's interesting to have everybody interested in what you're doing. That was a new thing for me. You know, everyone interested in what I was doing about something. And with that, you have a certain amount of responsibility. You know, and it's because then you realize that if you do something, you've got to do it right, because somebody may try to emulate you and not take care of the patient the best way unless it's done right. So I think it's important for young physicians to be involved in science, both at the clinical science, which I mean clinical trials, and both at the basic science.
Some of your early work with robotics was done in Germany, if I'm not mistaken, is that right?
Yes, I worked in the laboratories in Leipzig. And of course Leipzig was a great university. That was where many of the early physiologists who influenced the Hopkins School of Physiology, you know, Carl Ludwig was there. He influenced the Cambridge School, Sir Michael Foster, that strain, and also the Johns Hopkins School and the William Henry Howe. So you can see the influences of certain schools. And so the Leipzig School was very interesting to me. As you know, it's in East Germany. It was bombed during the war, and basically during the communist regime was really suppressed. And that's beginning to emerge as another fine academic center. And a lot of money there now from the West to build these cardiovascular diseases center, and of course the robotics came out of that.
Well, let's look at the practice of surgery briefly here. I'm sure there are standard surgical interventions that you've learned about and used over the course of your career. How have these evolved from the time you started your residency?
Well, they've evolved a lot. First off, I think some of the great things in surgery that have evolved are things such as total parenteral nutrition. The great work of Stanley Dudrick taught us that even though a patient is lying in bed not doing much, that he or she is metabolizing at a much greater rate than they were running around the racetrack. So therefore, that even in the early periods of an infirmity, a ventilator patient, you need to start alimenting them with parenteral, intravenous alimentation.
And that's just the body's response to that invasion.
You become catabolic instead of anabolic. You know, as you destroy rather than build. And so therefore, Dudrick saved many, many lives by getting people in shape so that you can get them off the ventilator. You get them through the operation, and they just withered. Well, now, you know, Dudrick's great advances were very important. A number of things in anesthesia, in antibiotics. These are the major things that change surgery. In cardiac surgery, clearly myocardial preservation. How to protect the heart while you're doing these operations. Remember, during my career, coronary surgery was developed. Valvular surgery was expanded. New types of prosthetic valves. I've basically lived most of the last two-thirds of the history of cardiac surgery, with the pump being developed in 1953, first valve being put in 1960. You know, you start talking about the first coronary bypass done in, you know, 64, 65. You know, the year I graduated from high school. Then you start talking about that. I've lived most of the stuff. Oxygenators have improved. Cardiopulmonary perfusion. The heart-lung machine has improved. But more recently, the great improvements in the last 5 years have been using minimally invasive techniques. Smaller incisions. And I think we've been involved in a lot of the development of that work. Specialized connectors to connect grafts to the aorta and to the heart, without having to sew them on, you don't have to put clamps on the aorta. Echo devices that allow you to assess what's inside the heart in detail before you do the operation, and then assess your success afterwards. The ability to prevent having to catheterize babies by just echoing them before surgery. The robotic work that's coming along. The new technologies in glues, bioglues. The new technologies coming along in transplantation and stem cell work, developing myocytes to be able to repopulate a scarred muscle. So, you know, you let the stuff iterate, maybe 20% of this will come to fruition, but still, we'll move the science ahead.
What was the relationship between what you were experiencing and the work that was going on in Houston, for instance?
What do you mean?
Well, I grew up in Houston.
What work is going on in Houston? They're doing a lot of clinical work. The only real major stuff in cardiac surgery in Houston is a lot of the ventricular assist device work. The Bakey heart. And Texas Heart, not a lot of basic science going on there. Lance Gould's doing a whole bunch of stuff on scanning and stuff. So it's, you know, the thing about it, it's all the great centers were producing this stuff 20 years ago, 30 years ago. Mm-hmm. Now, many centers are producing a great deal of new technology. It's not just Hopkins or Houston or Baylor or wherever. Gotta eat. Pause.
Push the pause on the far right. There you go.